Hello and welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity. That was a very, very sloppy piano entry. Last week, or the last time the podcast aired, Jim Boja dared me. He challenged me. He said, I bet you couldn't, we should play the theme song on the piano. So I went downstairs to my very, very nice piano. This piano is probably the nicest thing I own. It is a 1932 Fisher, and so sometimes I say that I'm finger banging the old widow Fisher, when in fact I'm just playing the piano very, very poorly. So anyway, it is we're back here for part two of Rhymes Against Humanity with Jim Boja. This is RAH number 021, if you're keeping track at home. And we had ourselves a really great chat last time. Matter of fact, this is the second half of that chat. I'll tell you how long ago that was recorded. When we recorded that chat, Jim was in his 40s. So he has since celebrated a big old birthday. The news that we broke here when he finally came clean about his age, we had ourselves a really great chat. And like after we had gone like about 2 hours, I said, all right, let's wrap it up. And he said, but we haven't even talked about Japan or the Beatles. And I said, okay, Japan and the Beatles, let's do it. And so we kept talking for, about another hour or so, maybe a little less. And it was just as fascinating as it was before. And rather than edit it down and let you all miss any of the brilliance, I said, you know what? I'm just going to run it as a 2-part piece, because if anybody deserves two parts, it's Jimmy Jingle. So I don't even know where he is now. I think he may be in Japan, or if not, he's leaving for Japan very, very shortly. But we're going to run this basically. Queequeg is down at my feet. It is one of those really shitty days. It's all porn outside here at the Permanent Records podcast studio. Actually, we're not even in the studio, because we had to come downstairs to the dining room where I keep the piano. And I did decide to play the theme song on the piano because, it is in C, because since I started playing the piano a couple of years ago, my fear of girls has been replaced by my fear of the black keys. I can sometimes get up there for a G, play an F sharp if needs to be. But the point is, we're here to talk for another hour with Jim Boja. It has been fun, and I'm going to get pretty much right to it. We'll get this conversation going on, and we have a lot of cool stuff. You'll hear. You were locked in the first time. As always, please like the podcast on the Facebook. We have the Rhymes Against Humanity Facebook page. You can like it and like Jim Boja's page and buy Jim Boja's records. Oh, also, I would like to give a shout out to Permanent Records. Actually released a record this week. People, Places, and Things was released by Butch Ross. It's a solo work. His last couple of Johns have been instrumental and traditional songs, because he plays that skinny dulcimer thing. But this time, although it's a lot of dulcimer, it's a record of songs that he mostly wrote, story songs and such. And we're real proud of it here at Permanent Records. So you go over to butchross.com and you can pick yourself up a copy of that record. And if you do, this Permanent Records podcast, we don't really get anything from it, but Butch feels good. Also, you can check out the episode we did with Butch Ross, the Butch Ross episode, which ran, I think probably around in the late fall last year, fall or winter. So that's about. Another shout out to an alum. I want to let you know that Tom Hampton also dropped a record, a solo record. You know, he has become sideman extraordinaire for all kinds of famous and semi infamous peoples. Well, he just put out his own solo record, which he hadn't done in years, and he had himself a great release at the Sellersville Theater. So if you go to TomHampton.com and pick up a copy of his record. And that's Queequeg playing with the bone down there. Knock it off, buddy. I'll pay attention to you in a second. I'm at work. Do I come down to your job and knock the bully stick out of your mouth? So, anyway, thank you for listening to Permanent Records, and let's get right to it. Jim Boja, part deux, the sequel. This time, it's personal. So let's talk about Japan.
Okay.
Because I remember I think if I remember correctly, the first time you got back from Japan, you wrote on Facebook about how amazing it was that you came halfway around the world, started playing this coffee house, and people were singing along before you got there. They knew your song.
Yeah. So, yeah, which was not what I had expected. Because, what happened is that I just got an email one day from this guy, Keiji Matsumoto, who... You know, I was like, hey, I put on shows in Japan and I want to bring you to Japan. And it's like, okay, yes. And then there was a weird thing where...
A lot of girls end up white slaves that way.
It seemed like that for a second, because I couldn't figure out why, you know? Like, it certainly...
You're sitting on your couch. It really just happened, just like we all dreamed of.
Yeah, it really was like that.
I mean, oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really like... Let's check my email. What? You know, had no idea it was coming, didn't know who this guy was. And then it took, you know, it took maybe 6 months to set up the first thing. And,
right.
And he's telling me, you know, I'll pay all your expenses and then you'll come here and, you know, you'll play your shows and you'll make money. Like,
yeah.
Really?
Okay. Okay.
And then there was a thing with the airfare that the site that he was buying it through wouldn't process his card.
Okay.
And so then he writes me, he's like, could you buy the ticket?
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, I knew it.
At least now it makes a little more sense.
It's like, this is like the I am a Nigerian prince
right.
email that's just been like totally specified to singer songwriters.
Yeah, customized.
Yeah, customized.
Oh,
exactly.
We would all fall. Every
yeah, right.
One of us.
Right. Exactly.
That is a great scam.
Yeah, it's a fantastic scam. Like, let's stop doing this and let's start doing that. Let's write some singer songwriters. We know.
Love your music.
Yeah, yeah. Would you like to come to Japan? Need your credit card info.
Thanks, Johnny. Great.
Yeah, but you know, somehow that got worked out, and you know, the first time I went, I thought, worst case scenario, I got a free trip to Japan and I'll get to go play music and see the place.
Right.
I'd never been to Japan before
right.
and I never considered that could be something that I could do, right? So I get there and I play the first show. The guy actually meets me, you know, it's like, it's yeah. legit, you know, I have the thing. He gets there and we do the first show in Tokyo, which was like the second night, you know, like a night to try to recover from the 13-hour time zone
right.
difference and stuff. And I play in Tokyo, and people are very, very nice beforehand, and they seem really excited to see me. And, you know, I play the show, and I get a great reception, and they're really excited talking to me afterwards, and I'm just figuring, Japanese people are very nice. You know, like I have heard how polite they are
right.
and how wonderful they
this
are.
All
and
adds
look,
up.
Here they are, being wonderful and nice. And then the second night, Keiji, the promoter, he's like, oh, can I ask you a favor? I was like,
here we
yeah,
go.
I'm pretty sure you can ask
yeah.
me a favor. Yeah, like I'm here in Japan.
Right.
And you're
what
paying
do you
for it. Yes. He's like, will you play Several Thousand tonight? And, you know, because like Several Thousand, you know, just became like the song I just...
That was your hit way
yeah,
back
was,
in the 40s.
Right. And so, of course, because we are the diseased human beings that we are, anything that we do that actually becomes popular, we hate it.
We hate it.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to play that.
A story I always tell about that is people always ask, are you sick of playing Diesel Dyke?
Right.
And there was a guy in a band, and I now forget the name of the band. But the band, I played a show with them on at the Pontiac or Dobbs, I forget what it was at the time.
Right, right.
And he was a fisherman also. And so he had the gig and he was going fishing early the next morning. So on the way to the gig, he stopped and picked up some worms for fishing the next day. Somehow they get loaded in. He's playing his show. And at the end of the show, rock and roll, he starts eating some of the worms. The crowd loses their fucking shit. This is amazing.
That is amazing.
This motherfucker has to eat worms at every goddamn show. All I gotta do is sing Diesel Dyke. I'm cool with that.
Wow. So like, this is now
it became
his,
their
it became,
thing.
Oh, man, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So be careful what you pick. All you gotta do is sing Several Thousand.
Right. So, well, now I feel much better about
yeah.
it. Thank you, Adam. I'm glad I came. So, you know, the second night, he asked me to sing it. I was like, sure, you know, I'll sing it for you.
Yeah.
Of course. And it's towards the end of the show, and you know, people have been nice. And this is in a city, Kanazawa,
okay,
which is still on the main island of Honshu, but it's on the north coast.
Okay,
and it seemed to be less westernized than.
Right, okay.
Other places. And the audience was kind of like, it's not just all ages, it's all ages.
Ah,
you know, it's
gotcha.
Like that kind of thing
yeah.
where it seemed like, okay, this is everybody's...
What we're doing tonight.
Right, what we're doing tonight. And, you know, I remember seeing a woman who was wearing a coat that had the wooden dowels
yeah.
with the rope that, you know, like that's what the buttons
right.
were. And it's like, okay, this is crazy. You know, I'm in Japan now. Of course, it's all Japan. But you know what I'm saying. And you know, really what I thought up until this point was, I guess this guy brings over American musicians, and it's a thing that people go see American, like that's
come
a novelty.
See the round eyes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Like that's novelty. It's an American musician, and maybe he has a reputation for bringing over people who are good, so they come and, you know, like come to see the shows.
But it couldn't possibly be you.
But it couldn't possibly be me, because, you know, my record's never released in Japan or anything,
right.
Like, or whatever. And so I start playing several thousand, and I get to the first chorus, and like everybody in the audience starts going, every time I think about you, Sarah.
That's amazing.
And it was so incredibly amazing that like I nearly stopped. Like, you know, like you're nearly like, ah, what's going on? And I had the presence of mind to keep going. And, you know, now I'm doing the second verse and I come to the second chorus and they do it again. And, you know, now I'm looking at KG, you know, who luckily is like filming me.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? And literally, it, like another one of those things, kind of like the Bernadette Peters thing, I had a really clear vision of sitting on the park bench at Pretzel Park in Manayunk in like 96 with my Crest guitar. You know, like I remember the guitar, I remember the jacket I was wearing at the time.
Yeah.
You know, like I could see it and thinking like, I wrote this song on a park bench in Philadelphia, sitting by myself. And now I'm in Japan in a city that I'd never even heard of before, you know, getting the dates for this tour. And there are people here who know this song, you know, and it was like, I was welling up, you know, and,
yeah.
And then after the show, you know, we had this really beautiful time where pretty much the entire audience left together and went to a place that was a restaurant, but it was closed because the guy who owned the place was in the audience.
Oh, wow.
So he opens the place up and it's just really one room. The cooking area is in the same room as, and it's just a long, big, like picnic-ish table and benches and a wooden floor. And we all sit down and he just starts making us food. And it's all amazing, you know, all food in Japan is amazing.
Right.
And it's the second day or third day that I've been there. So it's all, it's still just freaking me out how everything that's put in front of me is incredible. And this was also the first night that I discovered shochu, which is like a Japanese vodka, sometimes made from potatoes, sometimes made from rice, sometimes made from wasabi.
Oh, okay.
Like they can, and it's really good. And they do this thing called oyuwari, which is they mix it with hot water.
Okay.
And so it feels good while you're drinking
it.
And you're singing, but it also
punches,
kicks it,
yeah.
Punches you at it, and. You know, we're at the third or fourth course of this meal and the shochu's really kicking in and I'm looking around, you know, at all of these people who are being so nice and so incredibly warm and they know my music, you know, and I still don't understand why. And, you know, I'm kind of like having one of those quiet moments where I'm like, you know, in case you're like, are you all right? I was like, yeah, yeah, I'm fine. I was just like, I still don't, like, they knew my music. Like, I don't get it. And instead of, and I don't know if he thought about this, but man, I'm so happy that instead of him telling me what actually happened and what, and you know, I'll get to that and the convoluted thing that happened with this, with me getting there. He just said, they have been waiting for you to come for a long time.
Oh, man.
And then I'm like, whoa! Like, that just laid me out, you know? And it was maybe the most sort of rewarding, humbling piece of appreciation for something that that, you know, that like, how did that work? Because, you know, because I remember this thing when I first started, you know, Mike Frank, right? Piano.
Yeah.
Has played piano for me for practically the longer than I've been doing this.
Yeah.
So when my divorce happened and then things happened, I moved in with Mike for a few months. And I remember, you know, so this is like 96. Probably would have been right around the time that I was... No. This is 96. Probably right around the time I wrote Several Thousand. But I remember at a certain point, Mike wasn't home. And I was just goofing around, playing tunes. And I played Song for the Asking. You know, the Simon and Garfunkel tune. This is my song for the asking. Right. It's like maybe the last song on Bridge Over Troubled Waters or something.
Something like that, yeah.
You know, it's not like a big hit. Right, not a big hit,
right?
But but yeah, deep cut. And after I played it, I just like had this thought of, well, see, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to make songs that go out into the world in a way that they have a like. Paul Simon doesn't know that I just played that song. Paul Simon has had nothing to do with me. Just, I mean, you know, he wrote the song, but like, it wasn't like it's his show or it got played on the radio. Like this song, this thing he created now has its own life and it goes off and it does its own thing. And that's powerful, you know, to like, that's, you don't want to be your own biggest fan.
No,
you
but,
know,
but also yes.
Yeah, right. But you know what I mean? It's like you want other people to actually take the songs into their lives and have it mean something to them, and they just like that music and it does something for them, and it's not just about like, I'm not blowing Paul Simon by playing his tune and you know, telling him how great he is. I just like the song. Like, I'm playing it for myself.
Yeah.
Because I like it, you know? And it does something for me.
As the writer of the song, you've given something of value to people.
Right, that is of value to them just because they like that thing and not because they're doing it to be nice to me. Or
exactly.
You know? And so that was the other thing that I thought of, like, particularly when KG said that to me. You know, I was like, they've been waiting for you. It's like, well, how? You know, like, why? And but even before I knew sort of how, I realized, well, this is that thing. Like, somehow this song got out and, you know, made its way around the world and made its way to these people. And they heard it and they liked it enough to, like, learn how to sing along with the chorus and stuff in not their first language. You know, like, that's pretty cool. And so I found out later what had happened is right when I first released Fidelity, which was my first album, which was the song that, or which was the album that that song was on. I was doing opening sets at the Point.
Okay.
You know, so it was like still early enough that I was doing opening
sets. Right, yeah.
And I opened for, Austin guy, Bob Schneider.
Yeah.
Right? And his bass player at the time was a guy named Bruce Hughes. So these are all like Austin guys.
Yeah, right.
And they're just traveling through. And Bruce Hughes came up to me after my, well, after the whole show. He's like, man, I really liked your set. You know, I really like those songs. He's like, I want to buy a copy of your record. And, you know, the record been out like maybe a month and a half, 2 months at that point. So I'm so happy that anybody's like, likes my set, likes what I do. I'm like, oh no, I'll give you a copy.
Yeah, take a copy.
And he said, no, I want to buy a copy because you did something good and it's worth something. So I want to buy it.
That's very nice.
And that was very nice. And it also like was one of these moments that like I think back on now that like I'm a guy, it, you know, it's like, do you ever think about the fact that, that there's sort of an unwritten code to like the job that we do. And like, there's stuff that you're supposed to do a certain way. And,
yeah. Right.
Right. And like, yeah. So like one of my things is like, you can ask your friends to put you on a list for a show. Yeah. That's fine. But record release shows pay to go to the show.
Yeah.
And buy the record.
Yeah.
You know, like it doesn't matter that they're your friends.
And that
like,
they're going to give you one.
Right. And they're going to give you one anyway. Right. Like we're all in this together. Do that. Right.
You played at the Ford at the Sidewalk Cafe, right?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I always think about that. Us all tossing that same dollar around all night. I put it in your tip jar. You
right.
Put it in
exactly. Exactly. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's what you do. Right. Right. And I think Bruce was like, that was the moment of, oh, wow. Okay. Like I just learned something here. And it was always like nice. It was a very nice gesture. It was yes. a nice vote of confidence from somebody who was really out there doing it early on.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, didn't hear from him. And then I got a call or an email or something from him, like maybe 6 months later. And he's like, hey, you know, I got this side band called The Resentments and we're putting an album together. And, you know, we play every Thursday night in Austin or every Monday night in Austin, whatever it was. And, you know, we've been doing several thousand and it goes over great. And, you know, and it's kind of like our hit song now.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And he's like, you know, could I record it for the record? Like,
no.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, they did, and it was a really nice version, and he sent me a copy of the album, and, you know, it's great. And that's probably, like, 2002.
Okay.
And then, you know, I would see Bruce if I was in Austin, you know, or if he was in Philly. Like, we'd see each other maybe once or twice a year. You know, it right. was not like we stayed in close contact together, but we were people who would cross paths and, right. you know, get together and stuff like that. So he starts going to Japan and he starts, well, he continues to play several thousand.
Oh.
And the thing about the Japanese is that when they get into stuff, they really get into stuff.
All right. So they're searching right? for authenticity.
So they're looking and they're like, oh, we love Bruce Hughes. Oh, we love that song, Several Thousand. Oh, nay, that's not Bruce Hughes' song. Oh, that's a Jim Boja song. Oh, well. Oh, he has records. And so they, you know, they would buy my records as imports and stuff like that. Like, I was stunned the first trip over how many people brought me CDs to sign that they didn't buy that night, you know, that like yeah. I had not brought with me to sell at the shows there, you know, like you own this, you know.
That's awesome.
Why would you own this? So you know, like that was an instance of like, okay, that song actually did that, you
yeah.
know, like
it and, actually, and without your help at all, you were right. barely involved.
Yeah, like right, like I played an opening set.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was like the only thing I had to do.
I remember I had one of my first shows at the Grape. Tom Del Colli would book me to open yep. for WNOC and a bunch of others.
Right.
So and I show up and this girl comes in and I still remember, cute little girl, 5'3", and she's wearing a it was a t-shirt, but it had numbers on it. It was number 12. And she comes up to me and she says, what time are you going on? And immediately I'm thinking, you know, she's in the other band.
Right,
she's
right,
in the
right.
middle band. Or, right. or she wants to go out and have dinner or whatever her deal is. And I told her probably around 9:30, 10 o'clock. And she's like, okay, great. I don't want to miss it. I'm like, wait, what?
You know, I'm the opener.
I'm the guy.
I'm not in WNOC.
And she's like, no, I don't like those guys. I came to see you. It's like, you got to be kidding me. So, yeah, but those right, first events when it's not your mom,
yep.
you're like, wow.
It's like, wow, that's an actual fan.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. It's still, you know, when it happens still, it's pretty amazing.
Ugh. Yeah. All right. You should, we didn't even get to talk about how you almost met Beatles. You were in.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's too good a story. So just like a couple of months ago was yep. the 50th year since the Beatles went on Ed Solomon.
Yep,
my grandmother
yep.
thought he was sure Ed he was Solomon. Jewish.
Ed Solomon
and Franklin Delano Rosenfeld. If she liked someone, not. She was sure they were Jewish.
Oh,
So 50
That's
years ago,
so
the Beatles went on Ed Solomon. So you, what exactly were you doing up at the, which is now David Letterman's joint?
Yeah, it's Letterman's studio now. And so what I was doing there was I was in New York rehearsing for a band that I play with called Mad Dogs and Dominoes that had a show that Friday night at like the Highline Ballroom. And so this was our Tuesday all-day rehearsal. It's like this big 18-piece band with all these insane musicians and me.
Play Joe Cocker?
It's a tribute-y thing, but it's kind of a weird concept. It started out, we did a Delaney and Bonnie tribute. And then realized that the musician, the sort of like core group of people in Delaney and Bonnie, a lot of them then went into Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Okay.
Same core band, Derek and the Dominoes. Same core band. A lot of those guys played on All Things Must Pass album.
Okay.
A lot of them played on the Bangladesh
concert. Are like British session players mostly?
Well, this is like, this is like these Southern guys that just wound up, you know, because they got involved with Clapton and then Clapton brought them into the All Things Must Pass. So it's like Carl Radel, Bobby Whitlock. And then, like, Leon Russell gets involved once you get into Mad Dogs and English.
Just like Waddy Wachtel, is he one of those dudes?
Waddy would be a little later than that, and I don't think in that same group of people.
Okay. But guys like
But
that.
The thing is, if you start playing the Kevin Bacon game with it, pretty soon it metastasizes anywhere. But it's like an old school kind of like rhythm and blues review kind of show where, you know, it's a four-piece horn section. It's four background vocalists, two keyboards, three guitars, bass, two drummers. And pretty much not everybody sings in the band, but almost everybody sings in the band. So everybody takes a star turn or two up front. And you know, it's not my favorite music in the world, you know, to play or to listen to. I like it, but it's, you know, there's certainly stuff I like more. But it's great live. You know, it's great to play in front of an audience. It's great for the audience. It's a lot of, you know, upbeat stuff in the Southern thing. And, you know, it, like, really works. And the horn section is, you know, like Blue Lou Marini's in the horn section.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? It's like cats, you know, and me. So we had a rehearsal.
I'm impressed Blue Lou's still alive.
Yeah, he looks great, man. He's got
be 100,
he's,
yeah.
He's all white-haired now and white mustache, but then he wears a white suit, and it's just like, you look more amazing than you've ever looked, you know? And I mean, you know, like, stupid little things like that, like the first rehearsal that we had, and I sang something. I don't remember what I sang, but, you know, then I went to sit down afterwards, and Blue Lou, like, pats me.
Nice!
Like, yeah, that was really good, man. I like that. It's like, I'm going to tweet that.
All right, so you're
yeah, so we've finished rehearsal. I am seeing a woman who lives in New York, and I call her because we get done a little early.
Despite the song from a decade earlier.
Yeah, I'm more than willing to make the same mistake 2-3 times.
Attaboy.
And this was, she already lived in New York, so I can't blame, you know, blame someone for living in New York if that's where they already live. It's just, if you're living with me, don't move out of my apartment and move to New York. That's all I'm saying. So so she lives in New York, and she used to work on The Letterman Show.
Okay.
And she is, as hard as this is to believe, a bigger Beatles fan than me.
Wow.
And a bigger Paul McCartney fan than even Paul McCartney.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty big. So I call her and she's like, okay, I'm outside the stage door at Letterman. I was like, what? Are you like going back to it? She's like, no. And one of her coworkers or former coworkers had tipped her to the fact that for that special that was airing on the Sunday night,
right,
Paul and Ringo went into the Ed Solomon studios. And Dave Letterman, who I think we can call Dave Letterman.
Indeed. Or Donald, actually.
right. Interviewed them, right?
Yeah.
But the thing was, because they weren't on the show, they weren't on the marquee.
Right.
So basically no one knew that they were there. So it was, when I got there, it was her and I, four other people, two of whom were paparazzi.
All right.
You know? And we're, and it's early February when it was wicked, wicked, unbearably cold.
Yeah, it was really cold.
But Paul and Ringo are inside, and you know, like for me, it's like, yeah, that's cool. That's cool. And when I think about it now, it's cooler. But you know, I probably would have gone, it's really cold. But my girl, she's like, we're staying.
All right.
Like, yeah, yeah, it's not
so
even
you,
a question.
You saw
so,
them?
So they come out. Well, so first off, this is an important detail in the story to me, to no one else.
Go on.
I'm going on.
Okay.
The door, so two black SUVs with the tinted windows pull up. So right. We know, okay, it's going down now.
Yeah.
And the door opens up and out walks Bruce Grackle. Bruce Grackle!
I apologize.
I know.
Who is that?
Bruce Grackle, and it may be Bruce Grackle or Bruce Grackle. Bruce, like, I don't know how to pronounce it because I've only seen his name
right.
printed. He is a music industry attorney. Gets better. He was Nielsen's music industry attorney.
Of course
attorney.
He was.
Of course he was, which is how I know him. And it turns out, through Harry Nielsen, he became Ringo's attorney and has been for like 35 years.
Sure.
So he walks out. I'm so excited because I'm expecting, oh, it's going to be Ringo or it's going to be Paul. No, it's Bruce Grackle. So
Bruce!
Exactly. I'm like that. Bruce!
That's crazy.
And he, probably realizing if he stops and talks to me, I'm going to quickly use it as a way to, yeah.
Who's your friend?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Are you British?
Right, so he just keeps walking and gets into that SUV. But I saw Bruce Grackle. That's pretty fucking cool. So now the door opens and Barbara Bach, yeah, comes out. And then Ringo comes out.
Okay.
And
how does Barbara Bach look these days?
Barbara Bach looks pretty damn good. A little bit of work, but not like Meg Ryan
right,
work.
Yeah.
You know, like tasteful work.
Okay.
And then Ringo, who is short.
Yes.
You know, and like you don't think about that. But then, you know, we're standing now 4 to 6 feet away. I mean, and there's nobody in between because there's nobody there.
Wow.
You know, and we could easily make a dive, but we're not doing that.
Right.
So, you know, so Ringo comes out and he's peace and loving us because what Ringo does.
Yeah.
That's his shield.
That's his deal.
That's his shield. But the thing is, he looks fantastic.
Yes.
He looks great. And he doesn't, while he always has the sunglasses on so you can't tell, he doesn't look like he's had work done.
Interesting.
He looks like he gave up drinking and drugging at just the right time.
Yeah.
And because then, a few weeks later, we were watching that Tom Petty documentary.
The big four-hour long one.
Yeah,
he commissioned. Yeah. It's a great documentary, but it's a little self-indulgent.
And it's you watch it and you're like, that was good. I wish it had been Scorsese that had made it, not because it just, it's not.
Who's the guy?
As great. Bogdanovich.
Bogdanovich,
yeah. It's just not quite as compelling as the ones that
it very much felt to me like Tom Petty had his hand in every second.
Yeah,
of the
could very
make
well
make sure
be.
You show that scene where I get tough in front of Roger McGuinn.
Right, right, I agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. So, but they show the clip of "I Won't Back Down," the video of "I Won't Black Down." I won't black down. I'll let you pick up on that. Other than cutting the ponytail, like, he looks exactly the same. And that's 91, 2, 3, something in there.
In there, yeah.
Like, that's 20 years ago, at least. So he looks great.
So he looks 50, even though he's 75.
Yeah, it's going to be, he'll be 70.
Oh, I can hope for
74 or something this year. Yeah. You know, it's peace and love. Hey, Ringo, it's all fine. And they say hello, and then they walk off, and they go back in the back SUV, and the door closes.
Nice.
And then, like, as soon as that happens, the door opens, and it's Nancy, new Nancy.
Right.
Gotta have a Nancy. And Paul. And Paul is wearing a North Face jacket.
Of course.
Asics.
Okay.
And has his, you know, do we say that it's orange? Do we not say that it's orange? But, you know, his hair that's not really...
Yeah.
you know, but it's Paul 6 feet away from you.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
What are you going to say? And he's very nice because he's always very nice. Oh, thanks right. for coming out. Oh, it's so cold out here. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I could say, hey, Paul, hi, it's nice to meet you. You know, I say my bit. And I notice at this point... my girl who said hi to Ringo is now silent.
Oh, because Paul's her yeah, ball, right?
Yeah, because she cannot.
She can't speak in front of
Paul.
She
cannot speak. So they get in the SUV, and by this time, Ringo's SUV has left, and they're gone. And now this SUV, the doors close, and we're at the curb, and the SUV is right there. And it's 53rd Street at like around 6:45 at night.
Okay.
So they ain't going anywhere for a while. So they're just sitting there. And, you know, we can't see in, but you can't pull yourself away from staring at the SUV where you know Paul McCartney is sitting in the back seat and you're like 3.5 feet away from the SUV.
Right.
You know? And then I notice... that my girlfriend is, like, she's crying.
Aww.
You know, she's, like, having a moment. And so...
like Shea Stadium.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, probably 30 to 45 seconds go by. You know, it seems like they're sitting there for 5 minutes.
Right.
But it's, you know, probably less than a minute, but, you know, close to a minute. And they get their break, and they start pulling off. And just... as they pull away from the curb and like the back window is directly in front of us, Paul rolls down the window. Like, hey, see ya. and she blurts out, I love you, Paul.
There you go.
You know, like just it. And Paul blows her a kiss.
Oh.
And the window goes up and they pull away. And then it's really Shea Stadium because now she's like, and then she turns and she hugs me and I go to start to hug her back. And then like, not in a jokey way, like, oh my God, I just like her knees get like, she buckles. She's now like, I'm holding her up. And you know, it's like, to me in the moment, it's like, oh yeah, there's Ringo and there's Paul. You know, because I've seen them both before and, you know,
yeah.
seen the shows and kind of been up close and had really good seats for shows. And I've pissed off Paul McCartney once from the second row. And I'll get there. But I saw them, like, together at Ed Sullivan Theater.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool. And then when we were watching that special... you know, really, she's like so much deeper into it than I am, which is really, really
yeah.
frightening for me to think about. But, you know, they're showing clips of, there's that clip of them pulling up to the Ed Sullivan Theater in the back of the limousine, you know, with the horses in front of
yeah.
them and the audience on the thing. And then they get the thing and the door opens and they run in. And she says... that's the door. That's the door that we were just at. And it's like, wow, all right. Well, that what, like, okay. You know, like,
yeah.
that's a pretty awesome way to, you know, meet them. I don't know, say hello to them at a comfortable distance where they don't have anybody tackle you. You know, like, but yeah, so that was all right.
That's all right.
That's pretty cool.
So tell what you pissed him off?
Yeah, I pissed Paul off. So remember after Wings when Paul didn't tour for a long time? Like
yeah.
now you think that like, oh, I'm going to see Paul McCartney. Oh, this week too?
Yeah.
You know, it's like that kind of thing. But he didn't tour for like 10 or 12 years.
Right.
And then he was doing his first tour. It was like right after he wrote all that stuff with Elvis Costello. So it was like there were good right. songs and stuff like that. And he's
yeah, so like 89.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought it was like early 90s, but it might be. It might be. There, yeah, yeah, exactly.
It was early 90s. So it was Dayton Danielle, not till okay, right,
right.
Okay, yeah,
yeah, early 90s. But I don't know if you remember this. When they first announced dates, there was no Philly date.
I don't remember that, but okay.
Yeah, and you know, because we didn't know. Because it wasn't like, well, of course, they'll announce later dates and they'll be in Philly. You know, it's like, well, and this was Mike Frank again and I. It's like, well, we got to go to one of these shows.
Right.
And it turned out that he was playing somewhere in Florida. I don't remember if we were in Orlando or if we were in Tampa or, you know.
Who cares?
Who cares? But he was playing on my birthday.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In Florida. And so Mike's like, look.
There it is.
That's what we got to do. You know, and it's like, it's going to be really expensive, but that's what we got to do. And it's like, yeah. And back at that time, you know, Ticketmaster was still phone stuff. And Mike Frank used to be a jiu-jitsu ninja master of Ticketmaster.
Okay.
Like he knew all the dirty tricks to do whatever you had to do. I don't know what it was. He wasn't scalping. You know, he was getting it through Ticketmaster, but it was black magic, black right. art stuff. And we got second row seats.
All right.
And we got, and as it turned out, we got like second row just off center.
Sweet.
Seat, you know, so it's pretty awesome.
Close enough to make Paul feel bad.
Apparently so. So they open up. There's no opening act, but there's this Richard Lester makes this promo.
The movie.
I was like, that that's cool. Yeah. You know, it's getting you all amped up.
And right.
And then the lights go down, and then they walk out. And Paul walks out, and he's holding the Hofner.
Yeah, the and violin.
Right. And remember, Paul never played the Hofner in Wings.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
No. So like,
I know it's still got that set list.
Yeah,
from the
yeah.
rooftop.
From right, exactly. So like, so now this is, you know, that so there's Paul, and he's got the Hofner. It's already a great day in
right.
Jim Boja history, right? And hey, do, right? And it's like, oh, you ready? Here we go. And he's like, one, two. And I hear, ba-da, ba-da. And I realize, oh my God. And remember as well in like Wings, he'd play like two or three Beatles songs, but it wasn't like the Beatles extravaganza
right.
caravan that he does now. So this was like also, we had no idea what the set list was going to be or whatever. So he's opening with Birthday.
On your
on
birthday.
On my birthday.
In the second
when
row.
When I'm in the second row.
He clearly needs to know this about
yeah,
you.
Right? Right? Exactly. Well, no, there turns out that there's another thing he needs to know that I'm about to find out. So literally, for the first measure and a half, I am probably happier than I will ever be in my... Like, it is...
Right.
All the stars have aligned perfectly, and this moment cannot possibly get any better. So, of course, all it can do...
Is get worse.
Is get worse. Which happens in the second measure.
You had one measure.
Well, and the pickup note.
Okay,
so,
I'll give you that.
You know, like... Yeah, so measure and a half.
Measure
six
and
beats.
Half.
Six beats. I was exceptionally happy. And, right, we know how... Ba-da-na-na-na-na-na. Right? Except
right.
the bass doesn't... The bass goes...
Okay.
Right? It plays through the breaks.
Yes.
Yes. Even you know that.
Yes.
You don't even like the Beatles.
I used to.
Right. Okay. Paul seems to have forgotten... how the bass part to Birthday goes because he stopped playing in the gap.
Oh, this is unacceptable.
And I'm like, all right, technical difficulties. And he comes back, and he stops again. I'm like, no, man. So they go to the four chord. It's the same thing. Are you kidding? And now we go back to the one chord, and I'm now officially pissed. I'm now pissed.
Worst birthday ever.
Right, exactly. It's like, how dare you, sir? How dare you? So they go to the five chord.
Okay.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he looks my way in the gap. So I look up at him.
Holding your air base.
Holding my air base. And shake my head.
Like it's time for you to play like, now, sir.
And I'm like, giving him like a nod of the head, like, you're supposed to keep playing in this section. Do you not know? And, oh my God. And he looks away. I mean, like, he does that. And he did not look in our direction for the rest of the show. We were getting no love for the rest of the show. But how do you not know?
Well, you think they rearranged it? He felt like having a caesura? Can he rearrange his own fucking song?
No, he can't, because it's not his own song. It's a Beatles song.
It belongs to us now, right?
Exactly. Like, you don't get to decide.
I would think that nobody does but he.
No, because he's not the Beatles. He's just a Beatle.
He wrote the song, though.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't like the canon is closed.
Really?
Yeah.
What about you? Do you dick around with versions?
I'm not the Beatles.
Oh, okay. So it's okay when you do it.
Yeah, well, because a couple of things. I'm still Jim Boja. Like the Beatles end. This is part of the Beatles ended. They're done. Like,
okay,
Paul's
I see what
not
you're
a,
trying
Paul
to
is
say.
Not a Beatle anymore. Like, I did not meet two Beatles.
Right,
you. I met two ex members of a band that used to be the Beatles. Come on, they're not those same guys. Right? Like, you're not the same person you were 10 years ago.
Right.
I'm not the same. They're certainly not the same people they were 40 years ago.
Right.
You know, like, they did those things. But, and because I'm sorry, man. Now,
it's
now,
okay.
We're into hour four. I had a meeting with Jeff Jones, who is now the president of Apple Records.
Okay. That's still a job?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's a real job now, because they just do all this reissue stuff and stuff like that. So this was in 2008 when they were doing the remasters, but the remasters weren't out.
Okay.
And I was very concerned with whether or not they were going to screw up the remasters.
Okay. Now, how do you feel that they did with the original releasing the British in the 80s when they released the British versions
that,
on
those
CD
were
mono?
Awful.
Okay.
Those were awful.
Okay.
Like, they sounded horrible.
Okay.
But what I was most fearful of, they did a couple of things that really frightened me, which is that at a certain point, they deleted the actual Yellow Submarine album from the catalog and replaced it with something called Yellow Submarine Songbook. Which, because remember, Yellow Submarine was side A, Beatles songs, side B,
the music, yeah,
right. So they got rid of that.
Yeah, nobody wants that, but
it doesn't
matter.
Right, doesn't matter.
It's a Beatles
that's
album.
Exactly.
You can't remove. I think that's different than playing it your way at live. I think I'll give the guy more wiggle room there. But you're right. You can't.
So let's
it's like
say
cutting Trotsky out of the books.
Exactly. You don't do that.
Right.
And then they also. They found a way, the thing I was really worried about was that, boy, this is really inside baseball, but
right,
let's go there.
Okay.
Stereo version of I Am the Walrus, right in the middle at the point that the BBC radio broadcast starts coming in,
okay,
becomes mono.
Okay.
And the reason it becomes mono is because they did the mono mix first, because they always did, because the mono mix was more important.
Right.
And that feed of the radio was live as they were mixing it. They just ran it into a channel on the board. It's not on the tape.
Okay.
It's just in the channel on the board, and that's just happened to be what was on BBC at that time.
Right.
And they were all that, you know. And so when they went to make the stereo mix, they realized, oh, we can't do that. So it just, they splice to the mono mix at that point, and it's mono.
Okay.
Years and years and years and years later, somebody found in the BBC archives the actual broadcast of King Lear that was being broadcast that night.
Oh, okay.
When they did the 5.1 release of the Yellow Submarine movie,
right?
They recreated a true stereo version and 5.1 mix by taking the BBC thing and then faking all the interference and stuff like that. And so they kept
Are you okay with that in the movie?
In the movie, I'm okay with it. But what I was worried about was their desire. Like, because Paul sometimes in particular feels like, well, but it can sound, it sounds better. You know, it's like,
I can hear the meat in my voice back then.
Right, exactly. So I was really worried that they were going to monkey with a few things. And so...
So you made a call to the president of Apple?
So my manager, Jeff Jones, who was very, very nice. My God, what a nice man to allow me to have done this. That is just, it's so incredible.
Hi, Jim Bosch, Philadelphia Rocks, bro.
Yeah. Well, no, it was, my manager knows him because before he had that gig, he was at Sony as part of their Jazz Legacy edition, division. And, you know, I think that's part of why, like, he was used to dealing with back catalog and, you know, how to create new pieces of product out of existing back catalog, you know, so that made him a very good fit for that job.
Yeah, that's all we got.
Whatever. Right, exactly. So my manager calls him and is like, hey, my boy's coming to London and, you know, he'd like to, you know, just wants to talk with you for a while.
He just wants to talk.
And for whatever reason, you know, I guess because, you know, they're good friends.
Right.
I mean, let's face it. It's only because they're good friends. You know, Jack got me a meeting with Jeff Jones.
Okay.
And then Jack tells me afterwards, he tells me that a couple days before the meeting, Jeff called him and he's like, hey, Jack, hey, you know, I see that I'm meeting with your guy, Jim Bosch, in a couple of days. I remember us talking about that, but why am I meeting with him again? And Jack told him, it's like, he's got a lot of interesting ideas. Which I think he was like, so I'm spending a couple hours with a crank? Yeah, you're spending a couple hours with a crank. But, you know, we had a nice discussion where I sort of explained that Apple is now in a transformative period between being a commercial entity that is creating product and stuff, but now you also, like, you're an archive of historical documents of the 20th century, you know, of cultural, significant cultural artifacts of the 20th century. And like,
I agree.
And I really believe this. It's like, it's, you now have to start really thinking about, yeah, you can repackage certain things in certain ways. And like, I didn't mind that Love thing that they did they, you know, like, hey, put it all together in a mix
here's
up,
a love
mashup.
Song, blah, here's blah, a love blah. Song, yeah.
But like, you gotta make sure that people understand that these are the albums that they made and this is what they sounded like and this is what the artwork was, and don't monkey with that just because there's new technology that you think can maybe make it sound better, because it shouldn't sound better. You know, it should sound as great as it sounded. It should sound like it sounded originally,
right?
Because those are the records that changed the world.
I would be more mad at Steven Spielberg for what he's done, for putting CGI.
Exactly. Like, I'm against all that stuff too, right? Like George Lucas with all the stuff he's done. Like, you don't.
And I remember seeing Woody Allen arguing in front of Congress about colorization. Back when Congress actually used to spend time on things like that.
Right. Before Ted Turner gave him money. He's like, but I'm making money on this. Right. And I mean, that's even worse because that's somebody else monkeying with work that isn't theirs. You know, like, I totally get that.
Yeah.
You know, this is more of a gray area because like you say, right, but they're the Beatles. They can do what they want. But like my argument is like, no, the Beatles are over. Like, Beatles are history, and that now needs to be preserved.
I read an interview with Antonin Scalia.
Okay.
Who actually made the same argument for the Constitution. He said it's a dead document, not a living document.
Yeah, but he's wrong. he's wrong. You know, like, those are two different, those
agreed,
are two
but
very
I just,
different things.
Of course, but it's funny to hear you making the same argument as him. He had a salad fork.
He usually does.
So when the Yellow Submarine came out, what did they do with the radio?
So the reissues, mercifully, are really well done and it's all correct. And the Yellow Submarine album is back to being the Yellow Submarine album.
Okay, great.
There is no more Yellow Submarine songbook, so you don't get the wrong mix of Hey Bulldog.
Right.
That was even worse than the George Martin stuff being gone, is you couldn't get the real mix of Hey Bulldog. They remixed it.
Right.
Because they thought it sounded better, and it didn't sound better. Had more bass, but it didn't, and you'd think, because that's such a great bass line, but no, it's all wrong. Don't monkey with it. Let me, you know, and what I will say this. Where I was kind of hoping that I could move the conversation while I was meeting with Jeff Jones is that Jack was telling me, my manager, who has known this guy for years, that at Sony, when he was doing the legacy stuff, he had people who worked, you know, under him who would be, you know, experts in Miles Davis or experts in, you know, I don't know who else is on, I don't want to say people who aren't on Columbia, but, you know, whatever. People who are on, you know, jazz guys on Columbia who will say, you know, there's that 63 concert here that we have the tapes for and the rights to, and, you know, that would be really, because that's significant, da 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 da, and I'll put the line, you know, put the liner notes together for it and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I will say this. I really do humbly believe that if you just turn everything over to me and give me 5 years, I would present the whole story in a way that was really, really great. In a way that connected everything together in a way that made you understand how this related to that, but it would all still be just all the original stuff, you know.
Because you wouldn't would you remaster?
No, God, no.
Okay.
No
remastering, no re-recording.
No, it's all now about, like, how do you present this? Like, I would like to see them start to take their website, which is still now just like a product website. Here are the last 3 things that we've done, and there's like little sub websites for each of those products,
right,
and whatever. And they have a tiny little history bar that's, you know, a page for each year,
right,
or whatever. So the thing is, you've got Mark Lewisohn, who's done the most, I mean, he's an actual historian. He's not just some dude who writes books about the Beatles, right?
Did he write that day by day recording?
Yes,
I had that book for a while.
Yeah,
I love that book.
Yeah,
that
book is amazing, and he's got another one, The Complete Beatles, that is that same thing, but it, you know, not just recordings.
The Complete Beatles, they made the documentary out of, right?
Yeah, well, no, that just was something with the same name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know that Lewison had anything to do with that. But, you know, they were so intensely documented, right? There was so much press coverage and whatever on them at the time. Plus, people don't consider this, but they were so, it is a miracle that they got signed by EMI. Because EMI was the most anal retentive record company of all time. They were all OCD freaks. And so everything's documented. You know, that's why that book can exist, is because EMI made engineers make notes on everything.
Right.
Right. And so, like, if you're a guy like me that has shitloads of bootlegs, you can use that Lewison book and find the exact date. You know,
sometimes
even
the
like
hour.
The 3-hour session where it was recorded and who engineered it. And then, you know, you go to another book that there's this amazing book called Recording the Beatles that they took 10 years to write.
Yeah,
that's just
that. Yeah.
Super geeky, like recording engineer stuff. But you want to know what mic they used on, you know, like what guitar through what amp. Into what microphone, into what signal chain, into what tape machine
right.
that particular track was. All that stuff is, you know, a huge amount of that stuff is documented. And so I would love to see the website start to become
all right.
all of that. Because Lewison has some sort of arrangement with, like, he somehow has something with Apple. He is a consultant for them. He's a whatever. So
right.
at least that stuff, and that's the majority of the stuff that you want, because that's the best research stuff and the stuff that's real and has the documentation to back it up and everything. That's the stuff that you want to base this all on. But why can't that information get online where then you have, you know, links between... So start with... I'm such a big Beatles fan. I don't know the name of the song. Baby says, I'm in love with her. I feel fine. So you're listening to I Feel Fine. All of the you know, any press photos for that are there.
Right, yeah, complete in a
the recording track history. Covers from the 45s, you
right.
know, 45 jackets.
American release. British
link
release.
Into, here's all the recording information. You know, now link into, here's all the times that they played it live.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because, like, all of that stuff is, all that information's out there, and I just want somebody, and I think it should be them, to put it all in one place so that you can start to, you know, like go in at any
yeah.
point and find your way around. And I don't know. I understand that I'm a super obsessed Beatles fan.
Yeah, but you're not
but
alone.
Exactly. Like, you know, there's a ton of super
yeah.
obsessed Beatles fans.
I used to be one.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And so now there's, you know, one less, but still I think
yeah.
it's a viable idea.
No, yeah.
And the only guy who sort of, have you ever seen Neil Young's archives on Blu-ray?
No, but I know he's also very meticulous.
Right. Like, I would be happy having a meeting with Jeff Jones where he said, well, you know, this is a great idea, but, you know, we're going to get Neil Young to do it.
Yeah.
And I was like, fine.
Let Neil do it.
Perfect. He's more obsessive than me. But his archives project is, he did it. And it's like, fuck, there it is. You,
okay.
you know, it's not all inclusive yet, but the stuff that he had, it's all linked and you see where it all goes and you see, you know, he doesn't have as much information though. Like, he doesn't have as much recording information. You know, he was a hippie. You know, working in Southern California studios where they didn't keep,
right?
You know, notes of things, you know?
Except where the weed was.
Right, right. Only the important stuff.
That's a fascinating concept. I think that would be an amazing resource. It would be to work that way online and be
yeah.
That's a truly great idea.
Yeah, and the thing is, they kind of have to be the ones to do it because. the right, you know, who's going to get the rights to use that stuff in a digital format?
You know, like you link to it, right?
Like you're basically plagiarizing those Lewison books or whatever, you know. But if you get the rights from him to do that, and you're Apple, you know, then you can do that stuff,
right?
But the conversation never quite sold him on how I was a guy who he should really be listening to. And I was going to wow him with my...
But then one day he's going to take a trip to Japan. And the reason he's going to Japan is he has to smooth things over with Paul from 1980 in the week.
Yeah.
So he's going there and he's going to stop in... What's the name of the little town in the north?
Kanazawa.
He's going to go to Kanazawa for some reason.
Yep.
And they're going to be... Everybody's walking down the street and out from the loudspeaker on the street in front of the bus platform is several thousand. And he's going to look up and he's going to... And it's all going to fall into place.
It's going to fall into place.
He's going to write you an email.
Exactly. It's like, though I've never actually heard your music, I think I just did.
Jeff@apple.com.
Right.
And you'll think, what did I do? Did I win a Macintosh?
Yeah. I don't.
Apple.uk.co or whatever.
I guess it's got to be that, right?
Right.
Yeah, I don't have his email address. No. Surprisingly, he did not.
I'm sure he prefers it that
his
way.
His email address, but I got to touch Neil Aspinall's desk with the apples carved into it.
All right.
So that was all right.
We have gone on for far too long.
I know. Please. Well,
I may do this in 2 weeks. I don't know. I mean, in 2 sessions. Because this was all good stuff.
Really? Okay.
Anyway, you should play
feel free to cut everything out other than the Paul. To me, it's interesting once we start to talk about other stuff. It wasn't me. So.
But this is a great talk. My guest has been Jim Boja. Jim Boja, the ex-member of Four Way Street.
Right. Like, I can't go in and start changing Four Way Street albums. That would be wrong.
It's canon, man.
It's a canon.
So this was a truly really great talk. And I didn't even get to make fun of you too much about your bio. I had all kinds of stuff marked up.
Thank God, because you certainly had room to do that.
So why don't you play us a song and we'll get the fuck out of here.
Sounds great.
Whatever you want to
Thank
do
Thank you
here.
Very much, Adam.
Oh, this was a blast. This is going to go up on the 30th of, March?
Yep. Yeah.
So 11 days from now. You got anything you want to plug coming up in April?
I will be playing in Phoenixville at Steel City on April 19th.
Okay.
Then beginning of May, I'm going back to Japan.
Awesome. Fantastic.
There we go.
That's great. Play us the song.
Alrighty. Maybe you should stop it because now I have to think.
Okay. And we are back.
Okay.
And the crowd goes wild.
And the crowd goes wild. Yeah.
Well, I am so been so happy to be here with Jim Boja. Hand me my guitar, please. And who spoke with us for a good long time about many, many things. We even talked. We talked about the Beatles and everything else. JimBoja.com
yep.
is where you can go and buy pick up copies of his three records.
Probably.
And other stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we are going to play out of here with a little bit of Diesel Dyke. Please, thank you for listening. Dig the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and like it and everything like that. And be Jim's Facebook friend. He always has charming and clever, witty things to say.
Oh, don't I?
Sometimes.
I think I just proved it.
Yeah, you did. So this was a whole lot of fun. Thanks for
absolutely,
coming in.
Absolutely, Adam.
And
thanks
so
for having me.
Let's move the harmonica on. Screw it. We're not going to do that. Okay. Clear.